the latest agriculture news from across the state and the nation, here's Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Good Tuesday morning, everyone. The USDA received $10 million to help continue the development of its customer experience portal, farmers.gov. The money was awarded by the Technology Modernization Fund Board last Thursday, and that money goes to support the website, which helps to better connect farmers, ranchers, conservationists, and private foresters with USDA resources and programs. USDA Undersecretary for Farm Production and Conservation Bill Northey said, and quote, "This new resource will also reduce the time farmers need to take away from their fields today to fill out paperwork." For more information, visit farmers.gov. In today's show, we'll discuss how the dairy industry could be affected by Mexico tariffs, and Brian German talks with Annie Eckmoody about the federal milk marketing order. Also, variations in irrigation products from different companies could be costing some growers in their distribution uniformity. Taylor Hillman will have more on that in a few minutes, but also Taylor has an interesting report on how the almond industry is ultimately helping making better and more sustainable plastic products. And that's where we'll start today's news.
The almond industry is helping make better plastics. The Almond Board of California is helping USDA researchers find a use and value for almond hulls.
So originally, we're aiming for sustainable plastics that add value to agricultural products. So we're taking something that would be from the petroleum industry or the coal industry and replacing it with a biomass grown in the heartland.
USDA Bioproducts Research Leader Bill Ortz said that was the original goal, to replace carbon black, what makes tires the color they are, with torrefied almond hulls.
It's literally making charcoal. So if you have a backyard barbecue, it's the same stuff. And instead of burning it, you add it to your plastics. We thought it would just turn the plastics black. And so it would be a cheap blackener instead of using, you know, things from the coal industry.
Ortz said adding the torrefied almond hulls to plastic did more than just that.
So the first thing is it made it black. And that's all we thought it would probably do. And that was good enough for a while. The surprising thing is it made it more heat stable. So we improved the softening temperature by more than 10 degrees, which could really help for cheap plastics that are kind of gummy in the hot sun, and you can make them stiffer and more heat stable and lightweight and cheaper. So the charcoal is cheaper than the plastic.
And the best part is, Ortz said they source the cheapest recycled plastic available and make it much better.
So we use post-consumer, cheapest we could find. Yeah.
Bad distribution uniformity can cost a grower, and varying flow specifications from companies can contribute to that. Stuart Stiles is the director of Cal Poly's Irrigation Teaching and Research Center. He recently showed avocado producers how there's a wide spectrum when it comes to flow performance for irrigation equipment from different companies, and that can cause your uniformity to decrease.
Right. So non-uniformity has some different causes. One of the big ones is this plugging. Or differences in the flows coming out of the emitters due to the manufacturers, differences between the manufacturers. And the term that we use to evaluate that is called the CV, or the coefficient of variation. And it's a statistical term that we can go out and assess when we look at new product that comes right off the factory line. And some manufacturers are really good. They'll have a CV value of 0.03. Zero would be perfect. And some manufacturers have really lousy values, like up to 0.2 I've seen out in the field on some of the manufacturers. And we want to steer the growers away from the really high CV values and get them to recognize that the manufacturers that have those low CV values, they might cost a little more, but they have a better quality, higher quality product out on the market.
I'm Taylor Hillman for AgNet West Radio Network.
And now here's Brian German.
Nominations are continuing to be accepted for the Women's Catalyst Award offered by the Center for Growing Talent. The final deadline to submit a nomination is August 31st. The award recognizes individuals who support women's potential in the produce and floral industry by mentoring and fostering a path for leadership, development, and participation. Vice President of the Talent Portfolio for the Center for Growing Talent by PMA, Alicia Calhoun, noted the importance of this type of award.
We believe that by recognizing and inspiring a leader within the industry through this award, that we will be able to further build the industry's awareness of the value of mentoring women. And we want to make sure that we're continuing to find ways to create excitement around women's leadership. There's been lots of research around the benefit of having women in leadership roles within an organization. And we want to help further that knowledge within our industry to ensure that they see the need.
After several years, dairy producers are finally preparing for the establishment of a federal milk marketing order in California. Director of Economic Analysis for Western United Dairymen, Annie Akmudi, talked about when implementation can be expected.
The next few months are going to be a period of transition for California producers, although they're not going to see much of it, since a lot of it will be happening behind the scenes as USDA gets the program ready. And they're expecting their first pricing announcement to be on October 17 for an official implementation of November 1, 2018. So less than 6 months down the road.
Akmudi also noted some of the sentiment within the industry.
There's some people that are a little bit nervous about the change. It's a big change, but overall there's a lot of optimism and, you know, getting California producers on the level playing field with producers in the rest of the country. And so I think we've had 3 years of depressed milk prices, and so the potential change for an increase is definitely something that many are looking forward to.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. We'll be right back. Welcome back to AgNet West Farm City News Day. We've got more agriculture news right now.
While drought coverage in the D1 through 4 range was down in the lower 48 states last month, USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey points out that in the extreme and exceptional drought categories, D3 and D4,
that's mostly confined to the nation's southwestern quadrant at this time.
Meaning for the latest monthly U.S. drought monitor ending June 5th, a stretch from California to the southern plains. In fact,
the same five states occupy the top five in terms of D3 and D4 coverage.
So Arizona, Utah, Colorado, New Mexico, and Oklahoma, in slightly different orders, hold the top spots in the extreme and exceptional drought categories.
So in terms of D3 coverage, top of the list is Arizona, 74%. If you look at only D4, we see New Mexico at the top of the list, 18% D4 coverage on June 5th.
Rippey adds further drought intensification is expected in the southwest quadrant over the next week due to a continued lack of precipitation. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Coming up this Tuesday, USDA's crop production report and World Ag supply and demand forecasts. And once again, just as last month,
the big thing we'll look at this month in terms of what crops will be wheat.
Seth Meyer, chairman of USDA's Outlook Board, which will come out with forecasts for wheat supplies, exports, and prices, partially based on what will be the third survey of the U.S. winter wheat crop. Lance Honig with USDA's Statistics Service says thousands of growers have been surveyed about their yield expectations, plus there have been trained experts visiting thousands of wheat fields.
Taking counts, measurements, they'll actually be harvesting portions of those fields so that we can send those to our laboratory in St. Louis for analysis.
Meanwhile, Seth Meyer says to get an idea of what the demand and prices for U.S. wheat will be.
We'll be looking around the world at wheat, Northern Hemisphere wheat, so we'll be looking at Russia, Ukraine, European wheats.
And at possible needs for wheat among consumer nations. The USDA forecasts for wheat and other crops come out Tuesday, noon Eastern Time. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Washington.
Well, in today's livestock news, well, we told you yesterday that recently the World Meat Congress took place in Dallas, Texas, and Marty Smith, vice president of the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, was in attendance. He said they were able to speak to many cattlemen and buyers from around the globe.
I was able to talk to part of the delegation from France. Now, the people that I talked to there were people that were likewise cattle producers in France. A lot of the meeting was spent talking with buyers from other countries. The U.S. Meat Export Federation really promotes trade and supports our export markets. Likewise, the International Meat Secretariat works to eliminate trade barriers and to work out trade issues and difficulties. So we were talking about some of the things that do limit trade, both in terms of governmental aspects to it, tariffs and the like, and then some of the non-tariff ways that trade is prevented, and that is different regulatory schemes and whatnot, particularly with when we talk about the European community, they have a lot of non-tariff related trade barriers for us importing product there. So we are trying to work through some of that. This gave us an opportunity to meet with those people firsthand.
And Smith added that NCBA also spent some time discussing the North America Free Trade Agreement with delegations from Mexico and Canada.
We spent a lot of time talking with the delegations from Canada and Mexico about NAFTA. We also spent time talking with particularly some of the delegations from South Korea about the TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership Treaty, that is being discussed right now. Talking about increased exports to China, that's one of the huge open markets for everybody. And we certainly are seeing a lot more beef moving there. At the same time, we're seeing some tariffs being imposed there. So, yes, we spent a lot of time working on those aspects of it. And it's great to be able to meet these people firsthand, to have these kind of conversations with them, and gain a little bit better understanding of their positions, as well as letting them see actual cattle producers from the U.S.
Again, that was NCBA Vice President Marty Smith. And we told you yesterday that USDA had announced that California dairy producers voted to approve a federal milk marketing order for the entire state. Dana Cole, Deputy Administrator of Dairy Programs for USDA's Ag Marketing Service, gives a timeline for implementing the marketing orders here in the state.
The California federal milk marketing order will be implemented on October 17 with the announcement of the advanced Class 1 prices. These prices will then be used on November 1 when we actually begin the regulation of the entities, the processors, who will be regulated underneath the California Federal Milk Marketing Order.
And USDA said they will work the next few months to educate handlers who will become regulated by the new Federal Milk Marketing Order. I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West. AgriView with Evergreiner is next.
You know, not counting your personal matters, what worries you most? Well, a study has been concluded that tells us what the major worries are. Get ready now. Children's education, hunger, and animal welfare. Guess how they rank? Animal welfare topped the list, followed by children's education and then hunger. 41% of those who responded said animal welfare. There were other matters, but animal welfare surprised even the surveyors. It's not only farm animals that causes so much worry now. It's household pets, and particularly zoo animals. More women than men answered the survey. If those participating had their way, there'd be no meat on your table. That showed strongly in the study. And livestock farmers would simply vanish. And that's Ag Review for today. Everett Reiner, Southeast AgNet.
This is Farm City News Day by AgMet West. We'll have more of the day's agriculture news in just a moment. And remember, you can always get the latest agriculture news from across the state and the nation at our website at www.agmetwest.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to AgMet West Farm City News Day. We've got more agriculture news right now.
Honoring the flower that is a symbol of love and romance. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. June 12th is National Red Rose Day. Roses of all colors have been cherished for their beauty and fragrance for centuries. Red roses were used in many cultures as decorations in weddings and wedding attire. That's how it came to be known as the flower that symbolized love and romance. The tradition of giving red roses as the strongest message of love is still practiced today, with Valentine's Day and Mother's Day being the most popular days for sending the flowers. The rose is also the birth flower of the month of June. The state of California produces 60% of American roses. However, most roses sold on Valentine's Day are imported from South America. And almost all of the long-stem roses come from Ecuador. Due to its location of being right on the equator, it gets more sunlight per day, allowing growers to cultivate their crop all year long. I'm Kathy Eisen for AgNet West.
Good day, everybody. Albert J. Hernandez, the Untamed Chef for AgNet West. Welcome to the California Kitchen, where you can learn how to cook in under 3 minutes or less. I'm your host with the most. Let's get started. Our next recipe is a cilantro yogurt and sweet potato steak fries. This is such a simple recipe, and this is so great for watching a game on TV, or if you want to just make a nice snack for the kids. It's so simple and it's very, very healthy. I think you're going to love it. I need to take 2 cups of sweet potatoes. We're going to cut those into wedges. Now remember, with sweet potatoes, we want to remove the skin all the way off. And sweet potatoes and yams are the same thing, so don't worry about that.
If you want the brighter orange ones, you use what's the yam. The yam is just another way of saying sweet potato, because all that grow in this beautiful area of the Central Valley that we have are sweet potatoes. We want to call them yams, whatever you want, but they are sweet potatoes. And most of them grow, right here in this whole Livingston, Turlock, Central Valley area. And they are absolutely gorgeous sweet potatoes. Very simply, we're going to peel them and clean them. And I'm going to go ahead and take some seasoned flour, 1 cup of that, 1/2 cup of cornstarch. Now, you don't have to fry these. I love frying them because we're making sweet potato steak fries. However, these can also just be drizzled with some olive oil, salt, and pepper, and put them in a 425 degree oven for about 30 minutes. And they come out gorgeous as well if you don't feel like frying them. But it's very simple. Flour and cornstarch makes for a nice crispy fry every single time. And make sure once you cut the sweet potatoes that you leave them in water so they don't start to oxidize and start getting brown and looking pretty funky. We don't want that for any food that we're ever serving, especially on the California kitchen. I'm going to take 1 cup of Greek yogurt, 1 lime that we're going to zest, 3 tablespoons of finely chopped fresh cilantro, and just a little bit of salt and pepper. And in that simple, we have a nice cilantro yogurt. It's not so much of the creativity that we're looking for in the dishes we typically do on here. But sometimes simplistic food doesn't have to be very, very difficult. This makes for a really wonderful snack for anybody, especially kids who typically wouldn't eat something healthy. This is pretty healthy if you do it the roasted oven style. And even the fried style is not too bad because most of this is cornstarch and flour. But it is very, very tasty. It has a lot of depth of flavor, but more importantly, it really helps you to be more creative in the kitchen, and that's what we're always promoting. I'm Albert J. Hernandez. You can call me the Untamed Chef or AgNet West.
This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. We'll have more of the day's agriculture news in just a moment. And remember, you can always get the latest agriculture news from across the state and the nation at our website at www.agnetwest.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to AgNet West Farm City News Day. I'm Danielle Leo. We are living in the digital age, and farmers across the nation and world are looking to technology to better their farming operations. Roger Thyssen, business manager for specialty corn with Corteva Agriscience, was also one of the moderators at the 2018 Corn Utilization and Technology Conference in St. Louis. In an interview from our friends at agwire.com, Thyssen talks about how digital ag is serving not only the farmer, but the processor and the consumer as well.
At the 2018 Corn Utilization and Technology Conference, I am visiting with one of the moderators or chairman for one of the sessions that just took place. And I'm going to first of all let you tell me your name and who you work for.
My name is Roger Thyssen, and I'm business manager for specialty corn for Corteva, and I work specifically on the Pioneer brand side of the business.
Well, tell me the title of the session that you moderated here with several people that were talking on this topic.
Yeah, so the digital agriculture for a reliable supply chain. So that topic really is focused on how digital ag has become a bigger part of agriculture and how it's now helping take care of the needs of consumers and businesses that are looking to buy grain and understand where it's coming from and some of the inputs that we're putting on those acres.
So you had several folks here, a couple different companies that were talking. What are some of the things that you heard that are kind of like a takeaway for you from that session?
Yeah, it's interesting. I took away that they each are doing something different, but they are similar in their tasks. So some of them are farmer-focused in that they are trying to make sure that that grower has the information for them to stay profitable and to be able to have the information that a processor or a consumer may want of the product that they are growing. Some of it is again more food or processor focused. So just to make sure that that we are doing the things, or the grower is doing the things necessary to provide them with the information they need to provide the food ingredient companies that are requesting that information, that so they can tell a story to the consumer about the food products that they're eating.
We have farmers here who are attending some of these sessions, and we, as I've already noticed, in a couple different generations age-wise, how do you think some of this new technology is being accepted, and the understanding of like the need of what it can do and what it can do for them on their farms?
Yeah, so I think we sometimes discount how well some of the older generation actually uses the technology. So I think some of the older generations have grasped the technology. They're utilizing it. I believe some of the younger generations are going to be able to take that information, take that technology, and maybe use it a little more specific to acre profitability, just the different things that they want to do with those acres or for their farming operation. So I sometimes want to catch people or catch myself in that they are not pigeonholing an age group, a Generation Z or a millennial or a Gen Xer into how they consume the technology. I think all generations actually have done a nice job of using a technology and then utilizing it for what they're trying to accomplish for the processor or for the consumer.
Well, we've got an interesting climate in terms of the political spectrum, things like trade right now, big hot topics in this industry with corn, certainly in the area of ethanol with RINs and the EPA. It just makes for, I guess, a situation where farmers must be really looking for more stability. And can some of these new digital technologies help provide some of that for them during this type of a climate?
I think, you know, certainly right now it's no secret that commodity prices have been, you know, certainly held down somewhat here. And so anything to give yourself a competitive advantage, anything to create a profit beyond what you did 5 or 10 years ago. So I think digital ag will allow you to do that. And I think it will allow us to become better stewards of our farm ground and while we're still increasing our profitability on the farm.
So let's just, before we go, maybe make a comment about Corteva AgriScience and how what you're doing fits right into this digital agriculture, because we don't seem to have a real good name for it. Precision ag, digital ag, that means a lot of different things to different people too.
Yeah, so my role is really working with dry millers, wet millers, distilleries, grain companies, and it is on the corn, especially corn products part with white corn and waxy, yellow food grade corn. So those are certainly products that are going into the food industry and processing divisions. And the digital ag piece is critical for that, especially as consumers are starting to use digital information to learn more about the food that they're consuming. And that will tie it all together nicely, and they can understand where their food's coming from and how it was grown. I think digital ag will prove very well for the part of the business that I'm handling with Corteva and Pioneer.
Wonderful. Well, it's great to meet you, Roger, here at the CUTC taking place in St. Louis.
That was Chuck Zimmerman from AgWire.com. This is Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. We'll have more of the day's agriculture news in just a moment. And remember, you can always get the latest agriculture news from across the state and the nation at our website at www.agnetwest.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to AgNet West Farm City Newsday. I'm Danielle Leo. Mexican cheese tariffs could devastate American dairy export sales. Hear more after this. Mexico is an important export market for American dairy, specifically cheese. Mexico takes up to 28% of all U.S. cheese exports, which means it buys more American cheese than any other market. According to a report by the American Farm Bureau Federation, Mexico put tariffs in place in response to the tariffs on steel and aluminum put into effect by President Trump. U.S. Dairy Export Council President and CEO Tom Vilsack says those tariffs on cheese will potentially eliminate the competitive advantage we have in our number one market, and that's a legitimate concern. Last year alone, the U.S. held 75% of the entire Mexican cheese import market. The Mexican tariffs include a 15% duty on fresh cheese, which climbs to 25% after July 5th. Shredded or powdered cheese faces a 10% tariff, which again jumps up to 20% after July 5th. The full impact of the tariffs on the price of milk is still unknown, though. Greg Ibaugh, Undersecretary for Marketing and Regulations, says the Trump administration is monitoring the situation closely and will not hesitate to take action to prevent farmers from bearing the brunt of the trade negotiations. Last year, U.S. cheese imports to Mexico were worth $391 million. Speaking of trade, USDA Undersecretary for Trade and Foreign Agriculture Affairs, Ted McKinney, led a trade mission to Japan yesterday and will be there until the end of the week. He is joined by numerous U.S. businesses and government leaders seeking to expand export opportunities for U.S. food and agriculture products. McKinney said, and quote, "Japan is already a top market for U.S. farm and food products, but there are many new opportunities waiting to be tapped. Japan is an import-dependent nation. Its 130 million consumers have a real affinity for U.S. food products because of their quality, affordability, and safety. I'm eager to return to Japan and continue exploring all of the ways we can grow U.S. agriculture exports there." Trip participants include state ag department officials from 14 different states and 48 agriculture companies from across the nation, including 11 from California.
Lisa Moricle heads up fungicide and insecticide marketing at Syngenta for all of North America. She says there's a lot of exciting things happening in the crop protection industry right now, but Syngenta's breadth of product choices make things especially interesting.
Our broad portfolio allows us to engage with our resellers and growers in meaningful discussions that go beyond a single product, insect, or disease. But it's more than products, it's also our people. Our sales and agronomy teams in the field are willing to have as many conversations as it takes to make sure growers put the right product on the right acre at the right time.
Moricle says not only are Syngenta employees key to the relationship with growers, but retailers also are part of a collaborative and valued partnership.
We provide them the tools and the technical knowledge they need to support their recommendations. This may involve inviting them to field days or to one of our Grow More Experience sites, where they can see product performance in their local environment. Or it may involve a more direct approach by sitting down together with growers and discussing the benefits they can expect to see after using a Syngenta product on their farm.
With research and development a key focus for Syngenta, the company has rolled out several new innovations over the past season and have more to come.
There are also exciting developments in the Syngenta insecticide portfolio. In 2017, we launched Manecto Pro, which is a one-stop shop for broad-spectrum control of Lepidopteran and difficult-to-control sucking insects in specialty and vegetable crops. We also recently launched Force Evo, our new liquid soil-applied insecticide for superior control of corn rootworm and other early-season pests. Later this year, we'll be introducing a new granular Force formulation. Force 6.5G will be the highest loading granule sold in a bag, delivering improved logistics and handling benefits.
Despite a somewhat uneasy outlook for the ag industry, Moricle hopes growers lean on trusted partnerships they've built over the years.
As the 2018 season gets underway, the general outlook is mixed. Low commodity prices and market volatility will again challenge the agriculture community and continue to pressure growers to make hard choices about farming inputs. But Syngenta is poised to help both resellers and growers by being a consistent and reliable partner. We'll continue to deliver excellent products and services to our customers that clearly demonstrate a return on investment and contribute to their bottom lines. To all the resellers and growers who choose our brands, we thank you for your support and look forward to bringing exceptional solutions and value to farms across the country throughout 2018 and beyond.
For more about the insecticides and fungicides or other thought leadership from Syngenta, head to syngentathrive.com. Michael Clements reporting.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can follow AgNet West on Twitter and Facebook with @AgNetWest. Follow Brian German with @BrianAgNetWest, Danielle Leal with @DLealAgNetWest, and Taylor Hillman with @TheManOfTheHill. This has been Farm City Newsday by AgNet West.